Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The head of UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, urged the Security Council on Wednesday to support the agency's call for all countries to roll out inclusive national vaccination plans to end the COVID-19 pandemic. This means everyone, regardless of their legal status or if they live in areas controlled by non-state entities, Henrietta Fore told the meeting on ensuring equitable access to new coronavirus vaccines in places affected by conflict and insecurity. Her comments come as the agency steps up plans for the global distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. UNICEF aims to procure 2 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccines by the end of the year, in addition to the 2 billion doses of other vaccines that it obtains annually on behalf of 100 countries. Ms. Fore highlighted the difficulty of reaching an estimated 60 million people living in conflict areas under the control of non-state armed groups, as well as refugees and migrants who are routinely excluded from national immunization drives. After repeating the UN Secretary-General's call for a global ceasefire, which would help aid vaccine delivery, the UNICEF chief urged the Security Council to restart other stalled immunization campaigns. "We cannot allow the fight against one deadly disease to cause us to lose ground in the fight against others," she said. An update on the COVID-19 pandemic from the World Health Organization, WHO, shows that although infections and deaths from the virus have fallen significantly, regions including Europe are still in the grip of the virus as variants continue to spread. According to WHO, infections globally fell by 16% last week. That's 500,000 fewer than the previous seven-day period, and 10% fewer people died. In some European countries, this relative reduction is likely due to a strong combination of public health and social measures, the UN agency said, although it cautioned that there are still high or increasing infection rates among older age groups and or high death rates in most of Europe. France and the UK, along with Russia, the United States and Brazil, had the highest case tally in the past week, WHO data showed, highlighting the spread of the three main COVID-19 mutations that have been associated with faster virus transmission. The UN agency said that the UK variant is present in 94 countries across all regions, the South African variant has been found in 46 countries, and the Brazilian or Japanese variant is now in 21. More than 2.6 million people in Somalia face an extreme food insecurity crisis, the UN Agriculture Agency warned on Wednesday. Poor rainfall, flooding, and an upsurge in desert locusts are mainly to blame, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization FAO said, before cautioning that the situation could worsen without large-scale and sustained humanitarian aid. In addition to damage caused by locust infestations to pasture and crops countrywide, weather forecasts point to below average rainfall from April to June across most of the country, which will threaten millions of people. Working with the government of Somalia, FAO country representative Etienne Petterschmidt said that although the agency's teams and partners have delivered assistance and livelihood support, it's crucial to expand the emergency response to keep people eating, save lives, and protect livelihoods. From July to December 2020, FAO helped to reach more than 1.8 million people per month in parts of Somalia. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you worried about methane pushing us over the precipice of global warming? You should be. About one quarter of the climate-changing impact is coming from methane, compared to the big share for carbon dioxide. But if your sources point to methane plumes rising up from the seabed north of Siberia, you are being misdirected. We humans produce far more methane emissions burning so-called natural gas. The methane leaks out everywhere, from the wellheads to pipelines and even your home gas meter if you have one. Later in the program, we will get a taste of a new report called The Gas Index. It's put out by the Global Energy Monitor Group. I will play sample clips from a deep dive examination of methane leaks in America's gas system with podcast host and producer Chris Nelder's Energy Transition Show. But first, what is really going on in the Russian Arctic seas? Is a methane bomb going off in the hot Arctic? Let's find out what a collection of world experts on permafrost say. Some scientists and activists fear methane will rise up from the sea along Siberia, creating a heat emergency never seen before. But most major climate models do not include greenhouse gases from thawing permafrost at all. What is really going on here? Why is this formerly sleepy science so controversial? Will the answers determine how fast this world will heat up? Scientist Sarah Saidi asked some of the world's top experts. In December 2020, Saidi and 31 co-authors published the paper Subsea Permafrost Carbon Stocks and Climate Change Sensitivity Estimated by Expert Assessment. That sounds like good material for us to know. Saidi was educated in Iran, coming to Brigham Young University to complete her PhD in plant and wildlife science. Her intention is to make a bridge between top scientists and public policymakers who could make a difference. From Utah, Sarah Saidi, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Why did you begin to assemble world experts on carbon at the bottom of the Arctic Ocean?
Well, as you know, as you mentioned right now, the carbon stored in that region and the feedback that it will have and it has already on the global warming is one of those things that we hear about quite a lot. And sometimes I feel like we hear a lot of like mixed messages about the rate and magnitude of these feedbacks. But not only that, surprisingly, we see that in the main climate change reports or climate models, these carbon stocks and their feedback is kind of absent. So mainly because of uncertainty, of course. So I wanted to know, what do the scientific community knows about this system so far, and how do they think this system will affect climate change in the future?
And Sarah, you made a preliminary presentation of the science at the American Geophysical Union in December 2018. Were you surprised to find a few scientists were strongly opposed to your work?
Yes and no. No, because in general, one of the main benefits of, you know, participating in these conferences and sharing our work is having the opportunity to discuss our research and get feedback from other scientists, which help us to improve our work. And sometimes it's opposition, which is part of that, and it's totally fine. Now, specifically in the case that you mentioned, I was maybe a little surprised by the critic that was mainly concerned about that, how the results of our study are going to be used and if they will be misunderstood as like absolute answers, which I don't really think that was a fair critic because, you know, you think if you take anything out of context, that will become problematic. And there has been many studies that, you know, have used expert assessment. And as far as I know, the results have been used properly.
So to find out why these questions matter to the global future, why don't we set the stage a little? What is subsea permafrost?
Permafrost itself refers to ground that is frozen for at least 2 years in a row. Now, initially, permafrost was only on land, mainly in high latitudes, which was formed during the last glacial period. Now, after the last glacial maximum, as climate warming and the ice sheets and glaciers melted, the global sea level started to rise, and part of that terrestrial permafrost got submerged, which now we call that subsea permafrost.
So when the great glaciers captured so much of Earth's water supply, there was more land extending into what would have been a smaller Arctic Ocean. Were plants able to grow up there? I mean, where does the carbon that you're measuring come from?
There was. I mean, not on the glaciated parts, obviously they didn't grow up there, but there was on glaciated regions where they were pretty productive and plants could grow on those regions. And also, this time that the carbon that we are referring here, it is also was accumulated way before that time. So it was like over like hundreds or even thousands of years.
Now, everyone with a freezer knows that plants stop decomposing when they are frozen. Why does that happen?
Well, decomposing microorganisms such as fungi and bacteria, their activity decreases significantly in cold temperatures. So when we have frozen food or frozen ground in our case, the decomposition rate becomes very low. And that is why in the northern latitudes, especially in the permafrost region, organic matter could accumulate it during the years and become significant sources of carbon that we have right now.
Sarah, if there's liquid seawater above these Siberian shelves with the frozen plant matter on it, why doesn't the water just melt the frozen soil below it?
Well, it does. I mean, ever since this part of the terrestrial permafrost was become submerged, it is thawing. And this is obviously because the temperature of seawater is higher than the atmosphere. So it has been degrading, but the degradation rate is not really as fast as you might imagine. And I think it's estimated to be less than like a meter a year.
And how long has this frozen carbon from plants been sitting up there under the northern sea?
Well, ever since it has become submerged, so which was after the last glacial maximum.
So that's about 22,000 years ago, the last glacial maximum?
Yes.
Yeah. And where is most of the subsea permafrost located? How big an area are we talking about here?
So subsea permafrost can be found at the continental shelves of the Arctic Ocean and surrounding seas. The extent of it is estimated to be something around 2 million square kilometers, and a big portion of it is found in the East Siberian.
Right, and I think this is important to note, that you can't go up through the Bering Strait and turn right and study subsea permafrost, because there doesn't seem to be much carbon along the northern coast of Canada. You've got to turn left and go across the coastlines of Russia to do the research to find out what's happening there.
Yeah, well, I mean, the main part is there. I mean, we do have still subsea permafrost in Alaska and other shelves, but yes, the very main part is in there.
What are the best estimates of how much carbon is stored in subsea permafrost, and how would that compare to human emissions? How can we understand it?
Yeah, so this is one of the questions that we ask from our experts. And so their estimate was that the subsea permafrost region currently contains about 60 billion tons of methane and 560 billion tons of organic matter. Now, to compare that with human emissions, we have released a total of about 500 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution.
Well, obviously it would be a climate disaster if all that carbon emerged into our atmosphere in the next decade or two, but that's not happening. What are some of the factors that slow down the release from these subsea beds?
I think a good way to understand this is looking at the history of this system and see how it has changed over time. For one thing, these carbon stocks are distributed throughout the soil profile in the continental shelf, which can be hundreds of meters. So it takes a pretty long time for the temperature change in that deeper places. And even when it does, not all of the greenhouse gases that are generated because of either microbial activity or the gas hydrates, they cannot all reach the surface immediately. It's not really that easy. And even for those who do get to the seafloor and the surface, a lot of them will be consumed in the water column. So not much of that will get to the atmosphere. Also, we should remember that when we're talking about temperature change, we're only talking about a few degrees. So it's not like we're taking something out of the freezer and putting it in the oven. It's mostly like that we are taking it out of the freezer and putting it like in the fridge. It's a pretty low decomposition rate still. And also, another really important thing is oxygen. And these soils are very oxygen limited. So without oxygen, you don't really have decomposition. So yeah, it will probably take way, way longer than two decades for all of that carbon to get to the atmosphere.
Did your team of experts conclude that humans are forcing a faster release of carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere from those subsea permafrost beds?
Well, what our experts thought about the carbon stock's response to climate change is that subsea permafrost carbon response is pretty slow, and these stocks are pretty stable. And so the emissions that we are seeing today from that region, these are probably a result of paleoclimate change rather than this recent human climate change. However, they did mention that anthropogenic climate change can double these emissions in the future, but not really anytime soon. This might take centuries to happen.
Yes, it was surprising to learn subsea permafrost was already thawing long before the industrial age and even before human agriculture. How much was already lost, and why was that happening?
So the group of experts in our study estimated around 40% degradation of subsea permafrost since the last glacial maximum. And for the loss of soil organic matter, their estimate was about 10% of that was decreased since the LGM. And that is all because of the natural climate change, the paleoclimate change that happened due to the change of Earth's orbit, which lead to sea level rise and change of the thermal regime of the permafrost.
Do the experts that you consulted think we are in an Arctic methane emergency or approaching one?
Well, no. Our conclusion was more that the methane release seems to be more of a result of Apollo climate change. But obviously, that does not mean everything is fine. I mean, we are for sure at a greenhouse gas emergency, but it just is coming from our cars and power plants, not the subsea permafrost. And if we continue these greenhouse gases emissions, yes, we will maybe get to a point where reaching tipping points, but this will maybe happen in like in centuries.
Well, I think we should clarify one thing. Could you explain what is an expert assessment, and could you talk about how these are used?
You know, when the big challenge about making decisions for our future is always uncertainty, especially where we have limited information or if we are experiencing like new conditions that were not really familiar for us, like this pandemic that we are now. So expert assessment is an interdisciplinary approach that is often used for risk assessment and decision making in the face of uncertainty. It is especially useful when we can't get the information that we need for decision making from like the traditional science at the time. So using the knowledge of the experts related to the problem, and so these experts can be from diverse scientific backgrounds, we can kind of synthesize those knowledge and we can use that for informing policymakers. For sure, this methodology does not generate like definite answers. It provides more subjective and holistic estimates that can be used for like purposes of decision making or like future research priorities.
Now, one of the better known Russian permafrost experts is Dr. Igor Semilyatov from Russia's Institute of Natural Resources in Tomsk. Semilyatov, often working with his partner Natalia Shakova, has led most of the expedition ships to measure methane releases from the East Siberian Sea Shelf, and a couple of those research ships were funded by the Swedes. Sarah, you had 5 or 6 Russian experts in your study, but not Semilyatov or Shakova. Why not?
Well, we did invite as many permafrost experts as we knew, including both researchers that you named. And, you know, for many reasons, not all invitees can participate. This might be they don't like the expert assessment approach, or it didn't really fit their schedule, or maybe they never really opened my email. I don't know. But usually for this kind of research, around 20% participate rate is pretty typical. And, of course, it would be better if we could have them and other experts in our team. But, you know, hopefully in future assessments, there will be a higher participation rate and we can have more diverse experts.
Why would assessments of the Arctic methane risk become political or even too hot to touch for some scientists?
Well, you know, scientists are really trying to find the truth of everything. And their finding is not based on the expectations of public or politicians. The goal for scientists is to be objective as possible. And so in my opinion, what happens is, especially with hot topics like climate change, whatever you say as a scientist, you might be upsetting someone. Some people may accuse you of being so alarmist and exaggerating, and then another group might accuse them of, you know, like hiding facts. I guess maybe dealing with this kind of feedbacks of social media or other platforms can just be a little frustrating, and maybe that's it.
You must be aware that a small group of scientists and followers, encouraged by statements from Dr. Natalia Shakova, believe we are approaching a catastrophic release of methane from subsea permafrost. The University of Arizona professor emeritus Guy McPherson suggested humans would go extinct very soon just because of this. We have the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, which includes seasoned ice scientist Dr. Peter Wadhams from the Cambridge Polar Group. In your work to collect expert opinion, did you come across this?
No, our group did not come to this conclusion because of specifically of subsea permafrost emissions, like something catastrophic will happen. But I like to emphasize again that subsea permafrost is one of the many carbon sources on the planet. But what I understand is that we are definitely in a greenhouse gas emergency, which is mainly because of humans. I don't personally think it will lead to extinction, but I do believe if we don't do anything about it, it will, and it already is in some regions, have really serious impacts on the society's economy and our health and well-being in general.
Yeah, to me, the key question, which you raised earlier, is not how much methane is coming out of the seabed, but how much actually reaches the atmosphere where it can affect Earth's temperature. Do we know that yet?
This was one of the most important questions that we asked from our expert. This is really big uncertainties about how much greenhouse gas will get to the atmosphere and what the rate of this will be of this release from this region. Now, our experts estimated something around 140 million tons of carbon dioxide and 5 million tons of methane that will be released to the atmosphere each year from the subsea permafrost, which is kind of similar to the overall greenhouse gas emissions of a country like Spain. And it was estimated that if human-caused climate change continues, the release of these greenhouse gases can increase, but not abruptly again, but more like in centuries.
I really like this paper. It's worth reading by anyone, and anyone can read it. It's not too technical. But you had more than 20 experts look at possible impacts in the years 2050, 2100, and 2300. And for each year, you considered three possible emissions pathways employed by the IPCC. And those are RCP 2.6, which is the most optimistic. In my view, that's in the rearview mirror, but not everyone agrees with that. And you've got RCP 4.5, a kind of terrible middle ground, and then RCP 8.5, the worst-case scenario with very high emissions, and various scientists say we're on 8.5 now, but we could change that. Could you boil your results down to maybe the best-case scenario found by the experts and then the worst case?
So for each of these RCP scenarios, different greenhouse gas concentration is defined for the future. And so models can tell us how the temperature of the atmosphere, the ocean, will change in the future under each of these scenarios and different timelines. Now, based on this information and many other factors that alter the carbon feedback of this region, the experts of our study projected how greenhouse gas emissions will change in the future. Now, the first thing that we can conclude from the experts is that for all scenarios, a net emission was predicting, meaning that the output of the carbon from this region will be higher than the input of carbon. And now for RCP 2.6 and 4.5, which, as you mentioned, are like a little bit more optimistic scenarios, it was predicted that this increase will probably be pretty low, between 0 and 10%, especially in the early years until like 2050 or even 2100. However, for RCP 8.5, which is like, you know, business as usual, not only the amount of emissions was predicted to increase more, but also the uncertainty range was higher for these estimates, indicating that more aggressive climate change goes, like we go, the more surprises we should expect.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock, and from Utah, we're talking with Sarah Saidi about an expert assessment of methane and other greenhouse gases coming out of the subsea beds of permafrost, and most of them north of Russia, but also in other parts of the world. Do I understand this correctly, Sarah, that the study did not simply ask about the impact of warming, but also the related changes in biogeochemistry? I wasn't clear on that. Could you please explain?
Yeah, sure. So that is correct. In our questions, we did ask the experts to consider all factors that can affect its emissions, and many factors can be involved in that. For example, the extent of sea ice change, the amount of the light that gets down to the seafloor will change with both like photosynthesis rate, and it will affect also the waves and how the materials are mixed. And so, like many other factors, will just, affect this. So it's like way more complicated than just temperature. So that's why we kind of ask our experts to consider all of those factors.
And just to be clear, we've only been talking about permafrost under the sea. A huge part of the Northern Hemisphere, I think it's about 24%, is permanently frozen. And those lands are also thawing, and they will release carbon dioxide and methane. How does subsea permafrost compare to the land area and emissions?
So as you mentioned, terrestrial permafrost is about 25% of land in the Northern Hemisphere, which is about five times bigger than the subsea permafrost region. The soil organic matter density, however, it seems it has like a pretty similar density of, to the terrestrial permafrost region. One of the main differences we think was about how the systems will respond to climate change in the future, which, as I mentioned, our experts only estimated a carbon net release from the subsea permafrost region under all scenarios for all timelines. However, for the terrestrial permafrost, both carbon release and carbon uptake from the atmosphere is projected, depending on the scenario.
Yeah, there is some debate about whether a warmer north will encourage plants to capture more carbon, but your experts think subsea greenhouse gas emissions will be greater than northern plant life can capture. Is that right?
Well, yeah, that was not part of what our expert responded to, but the previous work showed that as much of like 100 gigaton carbon is now in the plants of the Arctic and the boreal region, but then 1,700 gigaton carbon is probably in the soils of this region. And so there is so much more carbon stored in these soils in both the terrestrial and the subsea permafrost that the plants can actually take, even if you like double them. And especially in the later years where the emissions will go on, I think like no matter how much plants you have, they really cannot like just keep on with the emissions from the soil. So I think the only solution we really end up is with just decreasing human emissions before we reach the point that this the Arctic vegetation will no longer be able to offset the permafrost emissions.
Your study notes several major Earth systems that could influence how fast these greenhouse gases could emerge, and it talks about, quote, changes in temperature, microbial activity, sea level, altered chemistry in the Arctic Ocean, and changes in photosynthesis associated with loss of sea ice or changes in nutrient availability, end quote. There could be tipping points in any of those, Sarah. It sounds like a pretty uncertain picture, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, for sure. It's very uncertain. These are complex systems which are hard to study, hard to understand, and there are so many components and feedbacks of these systems that scientists are just learning about. I do like to point out, however, that this system has been studied for a pretty long time. And of course, we don't have all of the pieces of the puzzle, but we do have some pieces. And I think what studies like ours do is that put that few pieces that we have so far and try to estimate at least a range of possible pictures that our puzzle might have. That can help us make better decisions today until we find more and more of that pieces, but that might take some time actually.
Is there a difference between methane frozen in seawater, called clathrates, and the subsea carbon in your expert assessment?
Yeah, so in our study, we wanted to know about all of the carbon pools that are in the Arctic continental shelf. And so there are like different kind of pools. So the first pool was the soil organic matter that has been accumulated in the soil profile of the continental shelf during hundreds of years, even before the sea level rise. Another pool of carbon refers to the sediments that are depositing into the subsea permafrost region during their years as a result of like Arctic river discharge and eroded coasts. And the last pool, I think that's the one that you were referring to in your question from the methane stocks that are like stored in this region. This can be now either gas or hybrid form, which is below and on the subsea permafrost.
Did your group of experts expect more danger from methane clathrates or other organic carbon in the seabed? What do we look for there?
So the way we define our questions, we look at all methane stocks together, as I said, hydrates and gas together. So we didn't kind of like differ the methane sources, like they were not asked separately in our assessment. However, it was mentioned by some of our experts that methane hydrates will not destabilize very easy because they're like really, really deep. And they have like, they're in this kind of good like stability zone where they have like in the kind of good good temperature and pressure conditions. But overall, as you know, methane is much stronger greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And even though in our study, the amount of methane emissions were estimated to be lower than carbon dioxide, but when we convert them to carbon dioxide equivalent, they did have a slightly more effect than organic matter.
So we know some scientists suggest rapidly thawing methane clathrates pushed Earth into abrupt climate change in the long past. What did you find out about that in this review?
Yeah, so there is a lot of hypotheses about like the climate change that happened in long past. I guess one of those contributors are hypothesis to be methane hydrates. But even that really change took place like hundreds of years, so.
There is a wide range of answers from experts for each case. Methane releases, for example, may be relatively little and slow, or it could be a lot much faster than we can tolerate. Why are there such differences among scientists who study subsea permafrost?
I mean, we had a pretty diverse group of scientists, both from like now both in the like the primary study region and their methodology of studying the system. And also when you look at like the published studies, which each cover different region, there's a really wide range of estimates. So like putting all of those things together and like when you put these diverse perspectives together, on some issues there are like high agreement between our experts, like for example, likely there's not going to be an abroad emission in the near future from this region. But in some other details, like you mentioned, because of this patchy observation and uncertainty, we see like really wide ranges.
Sarah, what do you think can be done to nail down expectations of greenhouse gases coming from shallow seas in the Arctic?
What was mentioned from almost all of our experts was in order to better understand the system and the possible feedback that it can have on global warming, we need more field observations. Deeper drillings are needed so we can study the old carbon and understand how the system evolved and what was the history of it. And another really important factor that seems to be ignored is the link between the terrestrial and the subsea permafrost and the possible thresholds that can be created. Like, for example, if the Arctic runoff rate increase and the sediment balance and other factors change, that might actually create new conditions that we're not really familiar with at all. And finally, I think the really the better collaboration between different groups of researchers, industries, governments of the Arctic countries, and like, you know, just improving the sharing data, they will for sure speed the process of our understanding.
And a lot more of the Siberian and other cold coastlines will be submerged as sea levels rise in this warming. Did your study add those new flooded lands when considering future releases? And if not, do we know how much frozen land will become new subsea permafrost?
We did ask the experts to include all aspects that can affect the future permafrost carbon feedback, which new subsea permafrost is part of it. But we did not separately ask that. But as far as I understand, if we considered the rate of sea level rise and the terrestrial permafrost degradation and coastal collapse, I don't think we should expect like much new permafrost to be submerged and like creating new subsea permafrost.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Sarah Saidi. I recently interviewed Canadian scientist Andrew McDougall about his paper, Is There Warming in the Pipeline? A multi-model analysis of the zero emissions commitment from CO2. And their team concluded that once humans stop emitting greenhouse gases, Earth will stabilize at whatever temperature is reached at that point. And they used 18 of the best climate models in the world. But McDougall told us only one model considered permafrost emissions, and I think that was for land-based emissions. It doesn't sound like permafrost science is getting into the big climate reports, and that means it isn't getting to policymakers. What can we do about that?
For a very long time, the permafrost was barely discussed in climate reports. Fortunately, for the terrestrial permafrost, we see in the past decade, it has received a lot of attention, and it has been pretty well discussed in the recent IPCC reports as well. However, for the subsea permafrost, it is still only acknowledged as like an unknown. I think synthesis activities that specially target the needs of climate modelers and policymakers is really essential. We should find ways that we like communicate the science that we know so far with all of its uncertainties and see how we can make, you know, the best of that, rather than just waiting until we know every single detail. You know, when we kind of ignore these Earth system feedbacks, I think it's somehow if, you know, you're giving them like a zero value, like they don't exist. To me, that seems way more problematic than including rough estimates that we have so far.
If you had a call with President Biden or his climate czar, John Kerry, what would you tell them about the threat from subsea permafrost carbon?
What I would say to President Biden, or really any leader, is that subsea permafrost is one example of carbon feedback that we're not even including yet in our calculations. And so there is really no room for risking or hesitating. Reducing human emission is more urgent than maybe the models are actually telling us. And if we do not reduce our emissions as soon as possible, we might hit some tipping points with each of these Earth systems, like permafrost, where there is really no comeback. And that will probably have a negative impact on every aspect of our lives.
Sarah, do you have further suggestions of the science that we need to get more settled answers on this important question?
I think one really important thing is the disconnection between public scientists and policymakers. There's really an urgent need to improve our communication and make the science more visible for both public and policymakers. You know, there can be misinformation for both sides. As for the public, many might think, we have passed the tipping points and there's actually no hope. And then for the politicians, everything that they deal is, you know, so complicating. And just adding these new issues like the Arctic carbon feedback maybe seem not really urgent for them, which I guess maybe scientists are somewhere in between, as far as I understand, that the majority maybe don't think we are hopeless, but it is very urgent, and there is no time to waste. So I think educating both public and policymakers about the science will really help to solve a lot of the problem, as well as for scientists, they really should care about this communication and try really hard for improving it.
I speak to a lot of scientists, and some of them spend most of their careers measuring layers of pollen or one species in particular. You set out to assemble the big picture, and not just in permafrost. Why did you go from Iran to America for your work, and what other subjects are calling out for you to assemble experts?
You know, growing up in Iran, I did witness many different types of environmental issues that directly impacted people's lives, like water shortage or air quality. And later that I became an environmental science student, I learned that many of those crises were not like surprise events that just happen overnight. And actually, our scientists knew about these events and predicted them a long time before, which if that science was heard in time and applied in policy, it would really prevent many harms that are now coming to families and people. So that's what I thought I wanted to do. I just thought like I wanted like spend my career to be sure that the best knowledge that is known so far can actually be used in like real life and in policy. And coming to the States, I kind of get the opportunity to work with many scientists from all over the globe to like address this really important environmental issues like fire regime change or water security or energy use and other things.
We've been speaking with Brigham Young PhD candidate Sarah Saidi. She's already working with top scientists all over the world, as you see. Sarah leads the new expert assessment on subsea permafrost published in Environmental Research Letters in December 2020. Find links to the science and controversies that we've discussed in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Sarah, thank you so much for this work.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We just heard from Sarah Saidi summarizing over 20 experts on subsea permafrost and the methane risk. Last week, we heard a similar report from Canadian climate scientist Andrew McDougall. Look that one up if you want a follow-up. So this makes two new reports from science saying methane emissions from the Siberian seabed are comparatively low but steady. Methane is increasing in the global atmosphere, that's for sure. We can measure it, but it's not coming from Arctic releases. Tropical bogs are the main source of the extra methane. We heard that from Radio EcoShock guest Ewan Nisbet. That was broadcast March 6, 2019. Dr. Nisbet collects air sample flasks from all over the world. The composition of the methane reveals new organic sources, not ancient plant matter decomposing. Humans burning natural gas is the second largest source of new methane into the atmosphere as it builds. It is something we can control by getting off the gas. Anybody who tells you this civilization can avoid dangerous climate change but will still burn a fossil fuel like natural gas is either deluded or gets money from the industry one way or another. Natural gas has been sold as a bridge fuel or even a clean fuel, but it is really a climate-killing fossil fuel. Any ads from the energy industry should say that, climate-killing fossil fuel, like a cigarette warning. If we keep lying to ourselves about that, times will get hot, hotter, stormy, and hard to live through. You can find at least a half dozen shows on Radio EcoShock questioning whether an Arctic methane bomb lurks in the near-time horizon. All but a slim few of the scientists I ask say a big burst of methane is not going to happen, and they explain why. I will put links to some of those interviews in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. This whole Arctic methane bomb scare came from a statement in 2008 by a single Russian scientist, Dr. Natalia Shakova. Now the whole story is off the rails. I may lose a few listeners or even a few donors who firmly believe in the Arctic methane scare. Some people quit their jobs expecting imminent social collapse when a burst of warming followed a 50 gigaton throwout of methane from the seabed that warmed up the climate, 5 degrees C. Even the Russian scientist who suggested that 50 gig release in 2008, she said it could happen at any time, has since denied that she said it. Well, there is a record of her saying it. Shakova and her partner Igor Semilyatov work from an institute in Tomsk, east of the Urals in Russia. They keep finding international funders, about one every year for 20 years, it seems like, to go out and look for large amounts of methane going into the atmosphere. They don't find it. But The Guardian prints their annual scary warning of imminent doom every year anyway. You probably know YouTube hosts who started this methane fear into a movement. Some environmentalists hold very strong beliefs that this is true. The whole Guy McPherson, we're all going to go extinct in 5 years, yes, he has said that, depends upon the 50 gig burst which, like Jesus, never comes. The methane bomb believers, like Sam Karana, get riled up when anyone challenges their beliefs. The Russian government helps fund the expeditions to find a natural methane bogeyman hiding in the Arctic, far away from humans. It's not us, you see. This fear could destabilize some people in the West, and it distracts from the real source of methane in that region, the gigantic Russian natural gas industry. It has a long series of leaky pipelines and poor practices. Siberian gas flows to the countries of the former Soviet Union and to the European Union. A lot of German homes and businesses run on Russian natural gas. That makes for interesting geopolitics, like last week's expulsion of diplomats and threats of more sanctions. The Russians and Europeans can fight like married people, but at this point, neither can afford to stop the gas flowing and the world warming. But why pick on Russia? Fossil fuel addiction has certainly gone global. Climate-killing methane is leaking out at every possible stage, as I said, and this happens in every country that uses so-called natural gas. But producing countries like the United States, Russia, the United Arab Emirates, Canada, and Australia release far more methane and carry more of the responsibility for the new burden hitting the atmosphere. Hardly anyone measures the leaks other than the vague estimates of product loss along the way. They can lose up to a third before anything is burned or more in the system. There is virtually no inspection, few regulations, and zero enforcement against these methane leaks. The leaks continue even when major equipment failures are pumping dangerous climate gases into the atmosphere for weeks or even years. You don't even need a permit. With today's low gas prices and corporations taking big profits, it supposedly doesn't pay to fix the leaks and keep wasted methane out of the atmosphere. Our kids will pay. Our grandkids will pay. Podcast host Chris Nelder just did a deep dive into a new report on methane gas leakage in the United States. It is no surprise when we discover, once again, that methane losses are far greater than previous estimates by the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. The U.S. Methane Leaks special from Chris Nelders on February 3, 2021 is 1 hour and 37 minutes long. It includes a few other energy headlines from around the world. You can grab the full podcast, episode 140, at energytransitionshow.com. Energytransitionshow.com. Here is a fast 15-minute sample mashup from that program.
Radio EcoShock.
It's better to get to a renewable future, a sustainable future, sooner rather than later. Get there before we do the environmental damage, not after.
For February 3rd, 2021, this is the Energy Transition Show with Chris Nelder. Global Energy Monitor, an independent nonprofit organization that researches energy and climate issues, has recently released the results of its latest project called the Gas Index. It looks at methane leakage attributable to natural gas in 71 cities across the U.S., using both extensive literature review and original modeling to attribute the sources of gas leaks. And its results are pretty startling. The Gas Index found that, on average across all sectors, the methane leakage rates in U.S. cities is 72% higher than a commonly accepted estimate from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA. It estimates much higher methane leakage from all parts of cities' gas systems, including distribution pipelines, customer gas meters, and leakage from appliances within buildings. In today's conversation, we'll speak with two contributors to the Gas Index, Mason Inman and Emily Grubert. Mason led the study, and yes, you may remember him from our discussion about his biography of M. King Hubbert way back in episode 10. Emily is an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at the Georgia Institute of Technology. They're both highly knowledgeable experts on the gas system, and I'm very pleased that they're willing to take the time to share the results of their new study with our listeners. We'll explore exactly where the gas leaks are and what can be done about each type of leak. And we'll consider some of the policies that could help reduce leakage from the gas system as a whole. And then we'll ask whether continuing to use gas in buildings is even compatible with the challenge of addressing climate change. Then in the news segment, we'll have a look at the IEA's new methane report. We'll expand on the story about why the French government has intervened in a planned U.S. gas export facility. We'll note a new IEFA analysis suggesting that Asian countries may not continue to invest in gas plants and other projects. We'll check out the largest U.S. offshore wind contract to date, and we'll hail the withdrawal of an oil major from the U.S. oil and gas lobbying group over its climate and energy transition policies. And now, our conversation with Mason Inman and Emily Grubert, recorded January 13th, 2021. So let's bring them into the conversation now. Welcome back, Mason, and welcome, Emily, to the Energy Transition Show.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
So today we're going to talk about the new report that you've done for Global Energy Monitor titled The Gas Index, which looks at methane leakage attributable to natural gas use in 71 cities across the U.S. Now, there have been many studies on methane leakage, but your press release says that this report is the first of its kind.
One of the things that I'm really excited about as an academic who looks at methane leakage and sustainability assessment, carbon footprints, that sort of thing, is that this study is, I think, one of the first ones that really looks at methane leakage from a consumer perspective rather than from a producer perspective. What I mean by that is, historically, we've spent a lot of time looking at methane leakage coming from oil and gas fields, from pipelines and things like that, really kind of focusing on maybe regulatory targets like producers or like pipeline operators. What this study does is really get into a full supply chain kind of analysis that contextualizes leakage in the context of the real decisions that people are making about natural gas use as consumers rather than just having a general idea of what the system is doing. So the fact that this really not only kind of incorporates a lot of the spatial variability that we haven't really probed that closely, but also puts this in context of the kind of day-to-day decisions that people are making about appliances and such, I think is a major contribution here.
So what are the headline results? How far off from the EPA estimates are we?
So on average, across all sectors, we calculated the methane leakage rate is 72% higher than the EPA's value.
Wow.
And more leakage occurs in delivering gas to residential and commercial customers than other sectors. So we calculated that the leakage rates for gas supplied to residential and commercial sectors is more than double the EPA value.
That's wild. So residential and commercial is the main areas that we need to focus on here. Okay.
Yeah, and we found these higher values than the EPA in large part because we were drawing on newer, more extensive measurement studies that are out there in the literature, but they haven't been incorporated into the EPA's approach yet. And these studies showed much higher leakage from particular stages in the gas system. So the gas index results also show a wide range of values between cities, with the leakage in the most leaky city, Indianapolis, about four times the rate of leakage for the least leaky city, New York City. So our city-by-city results highlight where efforts to fix the gas system can be most effective, and also highlights how cities can achieve large emissions cuts by switching homes and other buildings from using gas to using electricity.
So where exactly are these leaks occurring? I mean, is it that the pipes themselves are cracked or broken, or is it the fittings where one pipe connects to another, or what?
Yeah, so there are all kinds of leaks coming from many pieces of equipment throughout the oil and gas system. So there's leaks from pipelines, as you mentioned, and that can be due to a variety of causes, such as corrosion or damage from construction crews or damage from weather or damage from earthquakes, and so on. But not all of the leakage that occurs is from pipelines. So, for example, there's the long-distance gas transmission system, which involves pipelines, but most of the leakage comes from compressors that keep gas moving along the pipelines rather than coming from, say, little holes in the pipelines themselves.
Huh.
And there's also what they call behind-the-meter leakage that can occur from appliances such as furnaces, water heaters, and stoves. So when these turn on or off, they can have a moment when the gas isn't burning, but gas is still being released, and these releases of gas can add up. So there's various ways in which the leaks occur.
Gotcha. So when I turn on my gas-fired range and that little piezo electronic igniter starts going click, 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 but the gas hasn't ignited yet, that's one of the sources we're talking about here.
Yeah, it's not the biggest in the whole system, but it's one of them.
To piggyback on that a little bit too, I think one of the other things that we see is that because the Marcellus and a couple of other really dry gas production basins where you maybe don't even need to process the gas too much before you can put it in a pipeline, we don't see the same level of leakage that we see in older basins where there's maybe a lot of water coming up with the resource or other types of things like that where you end up having to separate methane out from other fluids. Part of the reason that we see oftentimes lower leakage in some of the newer basins is because the focus on shale and the actual ability to extract things from these tight shales is relatively recent. So some of it is age, some of it, like Mason said, is a distribution across different kinds of co-products, but a lot of the older fields are also correlated with just having a lot more fluid separations that lead to things like tanks where you have methane coming out of water and need to actually work on moving those things into separate containers, essentially, and that provides a lot of opportunity for leakage as well. One of the other reasons why we see a lot of variation when we start looking at methane leakage across different types of processes is that leakage isn't necessarily related directly to how much gas is actually being used. So a lot of the time when we see leakage, it's because maybe there's a maintenance issue, or maybe somebody left a tank hatch open, or maybe there's a valve that was installed a long time ago when we still actually used kind of intentional methane bleeds to provide some services to the facilities. And so I think one of the big challenges in talking about methane leakage is that it's not like a lot of other emissions where there's a really direct correlation between how much gas you're using and how much methane leakage you see associated with that use. So these really, really large points of variability, I think, often stand out to people that are used to thinking about CO2 as kind of a combustion process that's mediated by type of fuel, process efficiency, that kind of thing. With methane leakage, it's much more about what specifically is going on at a specific facility at a specific point in time. Some of that's predictable, and some of it's something that we can kind of start to understand as activity factors and so on. But a lot of it is really things that we really just need to measure directly. They're not that easy to extrapolate or predict without direct measurements. So the fact that we keep seeing these big changes and inconsistencies in the inventories partially reflects that this isn't something that you can just calculate if you know enough about the system, at least so far.
The standards for the integrity of a plug for an abandoned or closed down well were highly variable and changing over the years. And in fact, the history that we have of plugged and abandoned wells is only about 100 years. And since we're talking about a climate problem that will go on for eons, we don't really know how long these plugs will last. We don't really know. And there's all sorts of issues, technical issues in there that we don't need to dive into today that have to do with like the integrity of the cement, how long it'll last, or whether or not it cracks, or whether or not the casings between the well bore and the plug have integrity and so on. I mean, we really don't know that much about how long these plugs will last, do we?
This is one of the major motivations behind Megan Bivens' proposal for an abandoned well administration, actually, which kind of in association with a just transition for workers in the fossil fuel industry would really focus on getting real technical expertise and a lot of people on the ground checking out these abandoned wells and making sure that they're appropriately monitored. So, yeah, absolutely a problem and a potentially large opportunity for remediation-associated employment.
All right, so point taken, if we reduce the use of gas at the appliance level, eventually the leakage reduction upstream associated with that would also be reduced just because we wouldn't be opening as many new wells. But what about all the other stuff? What about transmission pipelines?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, if overall gas use was declining, then presumably you could shut down some of the long-distance transmission lines, and so then the leakage from those would be eliminated also.
That's true.
And then when it comes to cities, when you're looking at the distribution pipelines, so that's both the mains and the service lines, as long as the city's using gas, and if you just left the distribution system as it is now, the leakage might be fairly constant regardless of the rate of gas use, because as you said, the system has to be pressurized. Some studies that have measured the methane leakage over time, with daily measurements throughout the seasons, they've found this. So, example, in Boston, they've found that the leakage from the gas system varies relatively little throughout the year. It's fairly constant. But the consumption is much higher in the winter than in the summer.
Right.
So that said, there might still be ways of transitioning off of gas use that would allow for ramping down leakage that occurs from these pipelines. So it might be that if particular blocks of a city or neighborhood were transitioned off of gas, you could shut valves that block gas flows to those areas. And so that would eliminate leakage from the distribution pipelines in those areas without you having to remove those pipelines in the ground. Yeah, and then another category is the customer gas meters. So if a customer were to cease using gas, then presumably the gas meter could be removed from the building and the line coming up to the building could be capped at the surface. So if this was done properly, in theory there wouldn't be any leakage from this capped line. And so as you had customers ceasing gas service, capping the lines to their buildings would gradually eliminate the leakage from the customer gas meters.
True.
And then finally, there's the behind-the-meter leakage that's occurring in buildings from the pipes in the buildings or from the appliances. And so if customers cease using gas and the lines into the buildings are capped, then they wouldn't have any more leakage from within the buildings themselves and the appliances. So it would eliminate that part as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, when this concept of electrifying buildings in order to get rid of gas came up, weirdly, one of the things that was the most discussed part of that was shutting off gas ranges and replacing them with induction cooktops or whatever. And I always thought that was weird because, as you point out, it's only about 3% of the gas use goes to be used in a range. But you're right that as long as you have a single appliance using gas, then you've got all the associated stuff that goes along with that, from the production all the way down to the distribution system. And I believe RMI has also done a study on the health impacts of gas use in buildings, right?
Yeah, and they also pointed out the same issue of dangerous levels of byproducts from burning the gas that can build up in homes. So I hadn't seen this highlighted much before, but it's good that it's being brought to the fore now.
That was Mason Inman and Emily Grubert with Global Energy Monitor. Going into this interview, I really didn't expect that we'd end up where we did, wondering if we will have to shut down the entire gas system, or at least the parts that serve buildings, if we are to take effective action on global warming. After all, weren't we just told for the past decade that natural gas would be a bridge to a clean energy system for several decades to come? What if that bridge is a whole lot shorter than expected? Even if we thought that gas could continue to play a major role in the energy system as we progress toward total decarbonization, I think this new data analysis suggests that we cannot continue to have the extent of methane leakage that we now have. We would have to do something about it. But as Mason and Emily explained, and as several other articles linked into the show notes of this episode demonstrate, the costs of replacing aging pipelines and other sources of leakage are enormous. If we were to approach the question of how to proceed neutrally by doing a typical cost-benefit analysis to compare, for example, the cost of replacing all the leaking gas infrastructure with the cost of just eliminating gas and switching to renewable power, which, by the way, can be shipped over the existing electricity grid with perhaps minor upgrades, my gut tells me that the latter would be a whole lot cheaper and much more appropriate to the energy system that we think we need in the future. Much more work still needs to be done before we will really understand the true impact of methane emissions and the best courses of action going forward, and so I applaud the sort of open source approach that they're taking with this project. Coincidentally, as we will discuss in the news segment in a moment, a new report from the International Energy Agency just came out that is looking at methane issues as well. And to be sure, we have known for some time now that we really need to be thinking about how to electrify everything, no matter what. There are many other reports, including several from RMI, linked into the show notes, that show how electrifying space heating and water heating are economically sound ways to reduce our emissions, and how electrifying stoves can help reduce indoor air pollution. But we might want to think about weaning ourselves off of gas a whole lot sooner than we once expected. Well, that's it for this episode of the Energy Transition Show. Thanks for listening. You can find our show archive and give us feedback and suggestions at energytransitionshow.com and follow us on Twitter at Transition Show. The Energy Transition Show is a production of the XC Network.
That was podcast producer Chris Nelder from the February 3 episode Methane Leaks on the Energy Transition Show. Give it a listen and your support. Next week, who knows what news will break. If the virus doesn't get us, I hope to find time to bring you a real conspiracy theory. It's got everything, even the Russians. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for spending time with us here. Stay tuned for more Radio EcoShock next week.